Chapter 2. Birth of the Nazi Party. On the dark autumn Sunday of November 10, 1918, Adolf Hitler experienced what, out of the depths of his hatred and frustration, he called the greatest villainy of the century. The expression appeared in the first German edition of Mein Kampf, but was changed to revolution in all subsequent editions. A pastor had come bearing unbelievable news for the wounded soldiers in the military hospital at Pasewalk, a small Pomeranian town northeast of Berlin, where Hitler was recovering from temporary blindness suffered in a British gas attack a month before near Ypres. That Sunday morning, the pastor informed them, the Kaiser had abdicated and fled to Holland. The day before, a republic had been proclaimed in Berlin. On the morrow, November 11th, an armistice would be signed at Compiègne, in France. The war had been lost. Germany was at the mercy of the victorious Allies. The pastor began to sob. "I could stand it no longer," Hitler says in recounting the scene. "Everything went black again before my eyes. I tottered and groped my way back to the ward, threw myself on my bunk, and dug my burning head into my blanket and pillow. So it had all been in vain. In vain all the sacrifices and privations. In vain the hours in which, with mortal fear clutching at our hearts, we nevertheless did our duty. In vain the death of 2 millions who died. Had they died for this? Did all this happen only so that a gang of wretched criminals could lay hands on the fatherland?" For the first time since he had stood at his mother's grave, he says, he broke down and wept. "I could not help it." Like millions of his fellow countrymen then and forever after, he could not accept the blunt and shattering fact that Germany had been defeated on the battlefield and had lost the war. Like millions of other Germans, too, Hitler had been a brave and courageous soldier. Later he would be accused by some political opponents of having been a coward in combat, but it must be said in fairness that there is no shred of evidence in his record for such a charge. As a dispatch runner in the 1st Company of the 16th Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment, he arrived at the front toward the end of October 1914 after scarcely 3 months of training, and his unit was decimated in 4 days of hard fighting at the First Battle of Ypres, where the British halted the German drive to the Channel. According to a letter Hitler wrote his Munich landlord, a tailor named Pop, his regiment was reduced in 4 days of combat from 3,500 to 600 men. Only 30 officers survived, and 4 companies had to be dissolved. During the war, he was wounded twice, the first time on October 7, 1916, in the Battle of the Somme, when he was hit in the leg. After hospitalization in Germany, he returned to the List Regiment, it was named after its original commander, in March 1917, and, now promoted to corporal, fought in the Battle of Arras and the 3rd Battle of Ypres during that summer. His regiment was in the thick of the fighting during the last all-out German offensive in the spring and summer of 1918. On the night of October 13th, he was caught in a heavy British gas attack on a hill south of Vervec during the last Battle of Ypres. "I stumbled back with burning eyes," he relates, "taking with me my last report of the war. A few hours later, my eyes had turned into glowing coals. It had grown dark around me." He was twice decorated for bravery. In December 1914, he was awarded the Iron Cross, second class, and in August 1918, he received the Iron Cross, first class, which was rarely given to a common soldier in the old Imperial Army. One comrade in his unit testified that he won the coveted decoration for having captured 15 Englishmen single-handed. Another said it was Frenchmen. The official history of the List Regiment contains no word of any such exploit. It is silent about the individual feats of many members who received decorations. Whatever the reason, there is no doubt that Corporal Hitler earned the Iron Cross, first class. He wore it proudly to the end of his life. And yet, as soldiers go, he was a peculiar fellow, as more than one of his comrades remarked. No letters or presents from home came to him, as they did to the others. He never asked for leave. He had not even a combat soldier's interest in women. He never grumbled, as did the bravest of men, about the filth, the lice, the mud, the stench of the front line. He was the impassioned warrior, deadly serious at all times about the war's aims and Germany's manifest destiny. "We all cursed him and found him intolerable," one of the men in his company later recalled. "There was this white crow among us that didn't go along with us when we damned the war to hell." Another man described him as sitting in the corner of our mess, holding his head between his hands, in deep contemplation. Suddenly he would leap up and, running about excitedly, say that in spite of our big guns, victory would be denied us, for the invisible foes of the German people were a greater danger than the biggest cannon of the enemy. Whereupon he would launch into a vitriolic attack on these invisible foes, the Jews and the Marxists. Had he not learned in Vienna that they were the source of all evil? And indeed, had he not seen this for himself in the German homeland while convalescing from his leg wound in the middle of the war? After his discharge from the hospital at Belitz, near Berlin, he had visited the capital and then gone on to Munich. Everywhere he found scoundrels cursing the war and wishing for its quick end. Slackers abounded, and who were they but Jews? The offices, he found, were filled with Jews. Nearly every clerk was a Jew, and nearly every Jew was a clerk. In the year 1916-17, nearly the whole production was under control of Jewish finance. The Jew robbed the whole nation and pressed it beneath his domination. I saw with horror a catastrophe approaching. Hitler could not bear what he saw, and was glad, he says, to return to the front. He could bear even less the disaster which befell his beloved fatherland in November 1918. To him, as to almost all Germans, it was monstrous and undeserved. The German army had not been defeated in the field. It had been stabbed in the back by the traitors at home. Thus emerged for Hitler, as for so many Germans, a fanatical belief in the legend of the stab in the back, which, more than anything else, was to undermine the Weimar Republic and pave the way for Hitler's ultimate triumph. The legend was fraudulent. General Ludendorff, the actual leader of the high command, had insisted on September 28, 1918, on an armistice at once, and his nominal superior, Field Marshal von Hindenburg, had supported him. At a meeting of the Crown Council in Berlin on October 2, presided over by Kaiser Wilhelm II, Hindenburg had reiterated the high command's demand for an immediate truce. The army, he said, cannot wait 48 hours. In a letter written on the same day, Hindenburg flatly stated that the military situation made it imperative to stop the fighting. No mention was made of any stab in the back. Only later did Germany's great war hero subscribe to the myth. In a hearing before the Committee of Inquiry of the National Assembly on November 18, 1919, a year after the war's end, Hindenburg declared, "As an English general has very truly said, the German army was stabbed in the back." The attribution of the myth to an English general was hardly factual. Wheeler Bennett, in Wooden Titan, Hindenburg, has explained that, ironically, two British generals did have something to do, inadvertently, with the perpetration of the false legend. The first was Major General Sir Frederick Morris, whose book The Last 4 Months, published in 1919, was grossly misrepresented by reviewers in the German press as proving that the German army had been betrayed by the socialists on the home front and not been defeated in the field. The general denied this interpretation in the German press, but to no avail. Ludendorff made use of the reviews to convince Hindenburg. The other officer, says Wheeler Bennett, was Major General Malcolm, head of the British military mission in Berlin. Ludendorff was dining with the general one evening, and with his usual turgid eloquence was expatiating on how the high command had always suffered lack of support from the civilian government, and how the revolution had betrayed the army. In an effort to crystallize the meaning of Ludendorff's verbosity into a single sentence, General Malcolm asked him, "Do you mean, General, that you were stabbed in the back?" Ludendorff's eyes lit up and he leapt upon the phrase like a dog on a bone. "Stabbed in the back?" he repeated. "Yes, that's it exactly. We were stabbed in the back." In point of fact, the civilian government headed by Prince Max of Baden, which had not been told of the worsening military situation by the high command until the end of September, held out for several weeks against Ludendorff's demand for an armistice. One had to live in Germany between the wars to realize how widespread was the acceptance of this incredible legend by the German people. The facts which exposed its deceit lay all around. The Germans of the right would not face them. The culprits, they never ceased to bellow, were the November criminals, an expression which Hitler hammered into the consciousness of the people. It mattered not at all that the German army, shrewdly and cowardly, had maneuvered the Republican government into signing the armistice which the military leaders had insisted upon, and that it thereafter had advised the government to accept the peace treaty of Versailles. Nor did it seem to count that the Social Democratic Party had accepted power in 1918 only reluctantly, and only to preserve the nation from utter chaos which threatened to lead to Bolshevism. It was not responsible for the German collapse. The blame for that rested on the old order, which had held the power. A few generals were courageous enough to say so. On August 23, 1924, the Frankfurter Zeitung published an article by General Freiherr von Schöneich, analyzing the reasons for Germany's defeat. He came to the irresistible conclusion that we owe our ruin to the supremacy of our military authorities over civilian authorities. In fact, German militarism simply committed suicide. Quoted by Telford Taylor in Sword and Swastika, page 16. But millions of Germans refused to concede this. They had to find scapegoats for the defeat and for their humiliation and misery. They easily convinced themselves that they had found them in the November criminals, who had signed the surrender and established democratic government in the place of the old autocracy. The gullibility of the Germans is a subject which Hitler often harps on in Mein Kampf. He was shortly to take full advantage of it. When the pastor had left the hospital in Pasewalk that evening of November 10, 1918, there followed terrible days and even worse nights for Adolf Hitler. "I knew," he says, "that all was lost. Only fools, liars, and criminals could hope for mercy from the enemy. In these nights, hatred grew in me, hatred for those responsible for this deed, miserable and degenerate criminals. The more I tried to achieve clarity on the monstrous event in this hour, the more the shame of indignation and disgrace burned my brow. What was all the pain in my eyes compared to this misery? And then, my own fate became known to me. I decided to go into politics." As it turned out, this was a fateful decision for Hitler and for the world. The beginning of the Nazi Party. The prospects for a political career in Germany for this 30-year-old Austrian without friends or funds, without a job, with no trade or profession or any previous record of regular employment, with no experience whatsoever in politics, were less than promising, and at first, for a brief moment, Hitler realized it. "For days," he says, "I wondered what could be done, but the end of every meditation was the sober realization that I, nameless as I was, did not possess the least basis for any useful action." He had returned to Munich at the end of November 1918 to find his adopted city scarcely recognizable. Revolution had broken out here, too. The Wittelsbach king had also abdicated. Bavaria was in the hands of the Social Democrats, who had set up a Bavarian People's State under Kurt Eisner, a popular Jewish writer who had been born in Berlin. On November 7th, Eisner, a familiar figure in Munich with his great gray beard, his pince-nez, his enormous black hat, and his diminutive size, had traipsed through the streets at the head of a few hundred men and, without a shot being fired, had occupied the seat of parliament and government and proclaimed a republic. 3 months later, he was assassinated by a young right-wing officer, Count Anton Arkovalai. The workers thereupon set up a Soviet republic, but this was short-lived. On May 1, 1919, regular army troops dispatched from Berlin and Bavarian Freikorps volunteers entered Munich and overthrew the communist regime, massacring several hundred persons, including many non-communists, in revenge for the shooting of a dozen hostages by the Soviet. Though a moderate social democratic government under Johannes Hofmann was nominally restored for the time being, the real power in Bavarian politics passed to the right. What was the right in Bavaria at this chaotic time? It was the regular army, the Reichswehr. It was the monarchists who wished the Wittelsbachs back. It was a mass of conservatives who despised the democratic republic established in Berlin. And as time went on, it was above all the great mob of demobilized soldiers for whom the bottom had fallen out of the world in 1918. uprooted men who could not find jobs or their way back to the peaceful society they had left in 1914. Men grown tough and violent through war who could not shake themselves from ingrained habit, and who, as Hitler, who for a while was one of them, would later say, became revolutionaries who favored revolution for its own sake and desired to see revolution established as a permanent condition. Armed Free Corps bands sprang up all over Germany and were secretly equipped by the Reichswehr. At first they were mainly used to fight the Poles and the Balts on the disputed eastern frontiers, but soon they were backing plots for the overthrow of the Republican regime. In March 1920, one of them, the notorious Erhardt Brigade, led by a freebooter, Captain Erhardt, occupied Berlin and enabled Dr. Wolfgang Kapp, a mediocre politician of the extreme right, to proclaim himself chancellor. Kapp was born in New York on July 24, 1868. The regular army, under General von Seeckt, had stood by while the President of the Republic and the government fled in disarray to Western Germany. Only a general strike by the trade unions restored the Republican government. In Munich at the same time, a different kind of military coup d'état was more successful. On March 14, 1920, the Reichswehr overthrew the Hofmann Socialist government and installed a right-wing regime under Gustav von Kahr. And now the Bavarian capital became a magnet for all those forces in Germany which were determined to overthrow the Republic, set up an authoritarian regime, and repudiate the Diktat of Versailles. Here, the condottieri of the Free Corps, including the members of the Erhardt Brigade, found a refuge and a welcome. Here, General Ludendorff settled, along with a host of other disgruntled, discharged army officers. At the war's end, Ludendorff fled to Sweden disguised in false whiskers and blue spectacles. He returned to Germany in February 1919, writing his wife, "It would be the greatest stupidity for the revolutionaries to allow us all to remain alive. Why, if ever I come to power again, there will be no pardon. Then, with an easy conscience, I would have Ebert, Scheidemann, and company hanged and watched them dangle." Margaret Ludendorff, Als ich Ludendorffs Frau war, page 229. Ebert was the first president and Scheidemann the first chancellor of the Weimar Republic. Ludendorff, though second in command to Hindenburg, had been the virtual dictator of Germany for the last 2 years of the war. Here were plotted the political murders, among them that of Matthias Erzberger, the moderate Catholic politician who had had the courage to sign the armistice when the generals backed out, and of Walter Rathenau, the brilliant, cultured foreign minister, whom the extremists hated for being a Jew and for carrying out the national government's policy of trying to fulfill at least some of the provisions of the Versailles Treaty. It was in this fertile field in Munich that Adolf Hitler got his start. When he had come back to Munich at the end of November 1918, he had found that his battalion was in the hands of the soldiers' councils. This was so repellent to him, he says, that he decided at once to leave as soon as possible. He spent the winter doing guard duty at a prisoner of war camp at Traunstein, near the Austrian border. He was back in Munich in the spring. In Mein Kampf, he relates that he incurred the disapproval of the left-wing government and claims that he avoided arrest only by the feat of aiming his carbine at three scoundrels who had come to fetch him. Immediately after the communist regime was overthrown, Hitler began what he terms his first more or less political activity. This consisted of giving information to the Commission of Inquiry set up by the 2nd Infantry Regiment to investigate those who shared responsibility for the brief Soviet regime in Munich. Apparently, Hitler's service on this occasion was considered valuable enough to lead the army to give him further employment. He was assigned to a job in the Press and News Bureau of the Political Department of the Army's District Command. The German army, contrary to its traditions, was now deep in politics, especially in Bavaria, where at last it had established a government to its liking. To further its conservative views, it gave the soldiers courses of political instruction, in one of which Adolf Hitler was an attentive pupil. One day, according to his own story, he intervened during a lecture in which someone had said a good word for the Jews. His anti-Semitic harangue apparently so pleased his superior officers that he was soon posted to a Munich regiment as an educational officer, a Bildungsoffizier, whose main task was to combat dangerous ideas, pacifism, socialism, democracy. Such was the army's conception of its role in the Democratic Republic it had sworn to serve. This was an important break for Hitler, the first recognition he had won in the field of politics he was now trying to enter. Above all, it gave him a chance to try out his oratorical abilities, the first prerequisite, as he had always maintained, of a successful politician. "All at once," he says, "I was offered an opportunity of speaking before a larger audience, and the thing that I had always presumed from pure feeling without knowing it was now corroborated. I could speak." The discovery pleased him greatly, even if it came as no great surprise. He had been afraid that his voice might have been permanently weakened by the gassing he had suffered at the front. Now he found it had recovered sufficiently to enable him to make himself heard at least in every corner of the small squad rooms. This was the beginning of a talent that was to make him easily the most effective orator in Germany, with a magic power, after he took to radio, to sway millions by his voice. One day in September 1919, Hitler received orders from the Army's political department to have a look at a tiny political group in Munich which called itself the German Workers' Party. The military were suspicious of workers' parties, since they were predominantly socialist or communist. But this one, it was believed, might be different. Hitler says it was entirely unknown to him. And yet he knew one of the men who was scheduled to speak at the party's meeting which he had been assigned to investigate. A few weeks before, in one of his army educational courses, he had heard a lecture by Gottfried Feder, a construction engineer and a crank in the field of economics, who had become obsessed with the idea that speculative capital, as opposed to creative and productive capital, was the root of much of Germany's economic trouble. He was for abolishing the first kind, and in 1917 had formed an organization to achieve this purpose: the German Fighting League for the Breaking of Interest Slavery. Hitler, ignorant of economics, was much impressed by Feder's lecture. He saw in Feder's appeal for the breaking of interest slavery one of the essential premises for the foundation of a new party. In Feder's lecture, he says, "I sensed a powerful slogan for this coming struggle." But at first, he did not sense any importance in the German Workers' Party. He went to its meeting because he was ordered to, and after sitting through what he thought was a dull session of some 25 persons gathered in a murky room in the Sternecker Brau beer cellar, he was not impressed. It was a new organization like so many others. This was a time, he says, in which anyone who was not satisfied with developments felt called upon to found a new party. Everywhere these organizations sprang out of the ground, only to vanish silently after a time. I judged the German Workers' Party no differently. After Feder had finished speaking, Hitler was about to leave when a professor sprang up, questioned the soundness of Feder's arguments, and then proposed that Bavaria should break away from Prussia and found a South German nation with Austria. This was a popular notion in Munich at the time, but its expression aroused Hitler to a fury, and he rose to give the learned gentleman, as he later recounted, a piece of his mind. This apparently was so violent that, according to Hitler, the professor left the hall like a wet poodle, while the rest of the audience looked at the unknown young speaker with astonished faces. One man, Hitler says he did not catch his name, came leaping after him and pressed a little booklet into his hands. This man was Anton Drexler, a locksmith by trade, who may be said to have been the actual founder of National Socialism. A sickly, bespectacled man, lacking a formal education, with an independent but narrow and confused mind, a poor writer and a worse speaker, Drexler was then employed in the Munich railroad shops. On March 7, 1918, he had set up a committee of independent workmen to combat the Marxism of the free trade unions and to agitate for a just peace for Germany. Actually, it was a branch of a larger movement established in North Germany as the Association for the Promotion of Peace on Working Class Lines. The country was then, and would continue to be until 1933, full of countless pressure groups with highfalutin titles. Drexler never recruited more than 40 members, and in January 1919 he merged his committee with a similar group, the Political Workers' Circle, led by a newspaper reporter, one Karl Harrer. The new organization, which numbered less than 100, was called the German Workers' Party, and Harrer was its first chairman. Hitler, who has little to say in Mein Kampf of some of his early comrades, whose names are now forgotten, pays Harrer the tribute of being honest, and certainly widely educated, but regrets that he lacked the oratorical gift. Perhaps Harrer's chief claim to fleeting fame is that he stubbornly maintained that Hitler was a poor speaker, a judgment which riled the Nazi leader ever after, as he makes plain in his autobiography. At any rate, Drexler seems to have been the chief driving force in this small, unknown German Workers' Party. The next morning, Hitler turned to a perusal of the booklet which Drexler had thrust into his hands. He describes the scene at length in Mein Kampf. It was 5 a.m. Hitler had awakened and, as he says was his custom, was reclining on his cot in the barracks of the 2nd Infantry Regiment, watching the mice nibble at the breadcrumbs which he invariably scattered on the floor the night before. "I had known so much poverty in my life," he muses, "that I was well able to imagine the hunger and hence also the pleasure of the little creatures." He remembered the little pamphlet and began to read it. It was entitled My Political Awakening. To Hitler's surprise, it reflected a good many ideas which he himself had acquired over the years. Drexler's principal aim was to build a political party which would be based on the masses of the working class, but which, unlike the Social Democrats, would be strongly nationalist. Drexler had been a member of the Patriotic Fatherland Front, but had soon become disillusioned with its middle-class spirit, which seemed to have no contact at all with the masses. In Vienna, as we have seen, Hitler had learned to scorn the bourgeoisie for the same reason, its utter lack of concern with the working-class families and their social problems. Drexler's ideas, then, definitely interested him. Later that day, Hitler was astonished to receive a postcard saying that he had been accepted in the German Workers' Party. "I didn't know whether to be angry or to laugh," he remembered later. "I had no intention of joining a ready-made party, but wanted to found one of my own. What they asked of me was presumptuous and out of the question." He was about to say so in a letter when curiosity won out, and he decided to go to a committee meeting to which he had been invited, and explain in person his reasons for not joining this absurd little organization. The tavern in which the meeting was to take place was the Alte Rosenbad in the Herrenstrasse, a very run-down place. "I went through the ill-lit dining room in which not a soul was sitting, opened the door to the back room, and there I was face to face with the committee. In the dim light of a grimy gas lamp, four young people sat at a table, among them the author of the little pamphlet, who at once greeted me most joyfully and bade me welcome as a new member of the German Workers' Party. Really, I was somewhat taken aback. The minutes of the last meeting were read, and the secretary given a vote of confidence. Next came the treasury report. All in all, the association possessed 7 marks and 50 pfennigs, for which the treasurer received a vote of confidence. This, too, was entered in the minutes. Then the first chairman read the answers to a letter from Kiel, one from Düsseldorf, and one from Berlin, and everyone expressed approval. Next, a report was given on the incoming mail. Terrible, terrible! This was club life of the worst manner and sort. Was I to join this organization? Yet there was something about these shabby men in the ill-lit back room that attracted him, the longing for a new movement which should be more than a party in the previous sense of the word. That evening he returned to the barracks to face the hardest question of my life. Should I join? Reason, he admits, told him to decline. And yet, the very unimportance of the organization would give a young man of energy and ideas an opportunity for real personal activity. Hitler thought over what he could bring to this task. That I was poor and without means seemed to me the most bearable part of it. But it was harder that I was numbered among the nameless, that I was one of the millions whom chance permits to live or summons out of existence without even their closest neighbors condescending to take any notice of it. In addition, there was the difficulty which inevitably rose from my lack of schooling. After 2 days of agonized pondering and reflection, I finally came to the conviction that I had to take this step. It was the most decisive resolve of my life. From here, there was and could be no turning back. Adolf Hitler was then and there enrolled as the 7th member of the committee of the German Workers' Party. There were 2 members of this insignificant party who deserve mention at this point. Both were to prove important in the rise of Hitler. Captain Ernst Röhm, on the staff of the Army's District Command 7 in Munich, had joined the party before Hitler. He was a stocky, bull-necked, piggish-eyed, scar-faced professional soldier. The upper part of his nose had been shot away in 1914, with a flair for politics and a natural ability as an organizer. Like Hitler, he was possessed of a burning hatred for the Democratic Republic and the November criminals he held responsible for it. His aim was to recreate a strong nationalist Germany, and he believed with Hitler that this could be done only by a party based on the lower classes, from which he himself, unlike most regular army officers, had come. A tough, ruthless, driving man, albeit like so many of the early Nazis, a homosexual, he helped to organize the first Nazi strong-arm squads which grew into the SA, the army of stormtroopers which he commanded until his execution by Hitler in 1934. Röhm not only brought into the budding party large numbers of ex-servicemen and Free Corps volunteers, who formed the backbone of the organization in its early years, but as an officer of the army, which controlled Bavaria, he obtained for Hitler and his movement the protection and sometimes the support of the authorities. Without this help, Hitler probably could never have got a real start in his campaign to incite the people to overthrow the Republic. Certainly he could not have got away with his methods of terror and intimidation without the tolerance of the Bavarian government and police. Dietrich Eckart, 21 years older than Hitler, was often called the spiritual founder of National Socialism. A witty journalist, a mediocre poet and dramatist, he had translated Ibsen's Peer Gynt and written a number of unproduced plays. In Berlin, for a time, he had led, like Hitler in Vienna, the bohemian vagrant's life, become a drunkard, taken to morphine, and, according to Haydn, been confined to a mental institution where he was finally able to stage his dramas using the inmates as actors. He had returned to his native Bavaria at the war's end and held forth before a circle of admirers at the Brennesel wine cellar in Schwabling, the artist's quarter in Munich, preaching Aryan superiority and calling for the elimination of the Jews and the downfall of the swine in Berlin. "We need a fellow at the head," Haydn, who was a working newspaper man in Munich at the time, quotes Eckart as declaiming to the habitués of the Brennesel wine cellar in 1919, "who can stand the sound of a machine gun. The rabble need to get fear into their pants. We can't use an officer because the people don't respect them anymore. The best would be a worker who knows how to talk. He doesn't need much brains. He must be a bachelor, then we'll get the women." What more natural than that the hard-drinking poet, Eckart died of overdrinking in December 1923, should find in Adolf Hitler the very man he was looking for. He became a close advisor to the rising young man in the German Workers' Party, lending him books, helping to improve his German, both written and spoken, and introducing him to his wide circle of friends, which included not only certain wealthy persons who were induced to contribute to the party's funds and Hitler's living, but such future aides as Rudolf Hess and Alfred Rosenberg. Hitler's admiration for Eckart never flagged, and the last sentence of Mein Kampf is an expression of gratitude to this erratic mentor. "He was," says Hitler in concluding his book, "one of the best who devoted his life to the awakening of our people, in his writings and his thoughts, and finally in his deeds." Such was the weird assortment of misfits who founded National Socialism, who unknowingly began to shape a movement which in 13 years would sweep the country, the strongest in Europe, and bring to Germany its Third Reich. The confused locksmith Drexler provided the kernel, the drunken poet Eckart some of the spiritual foundation, the economic crank Feder what passed as an ideology, the homosexual Röhm the support of the army and the war veterans, But it was now the former tramp, Adolf Hitler, not quite 31 and utterly unknown, who took the lead in building up what had been no more than a backroom debating society into what would soon become a formidable political party. All the ideas which had been bubbling in his mind since the lonesome days of hunger in Vienna now found an outlet, and an inner energy which had not been observable in his makeup burst forth. He prodded his timid committee into organizing bigger meetings. He personally typed out and distributed invitations. Later he recalled how once, after he had distributed 80 of these, we sat waiting for the masses who were expected to appear. An hour late, the chairman had to open the meeting. We were again 7, the old 7. But he was not to be discouraged. He increased the number of invitations by having them mimeographed. He collected a few marks to insert a notice of a meeting in a local newspaper. The success, he says, was positively amazing. 111 people were present. Hitler was to make his first public speech following the main address by a Munich professor. Harrer, nominal head of the party, objected. This gentleman, who was certainly otherwise honest, Hitler relates, just happened to be convinced that I might be capable of doing certain things, but not of speaking. I spoke for 30 minutes, and what before I had simply felt within me, without in any way knowing it, was now proved by reality. I could speak. Hitler claims the audience was electrified by his oratory, and its enthusiasm proved by donations of 300 marks. Which temporarily relieved the party of its financial worries. At the start of 1920, Hitler took over the party's propaganda, an activity to which he had given much thought since he had observed its importance in the socialist and Christian social parties in Vienna. He began immediately to organize by far the biggest meeting ever dreamt of by the pitifully small party. It was to be held on February 24, 1920, in the Festsaal of the famous Hofbräuhaus, with a seating capacity of nearly 2,000. Hitler's fellow committeemen thought he was crazy. Harrer resigned in protest and was replaced by Drexler, who remained skeptical. Harrer also was opposed to Hitler's violent anti-Semitism and believed that Hitler was alienating the working-class masses. These were the real reasons why he resigned. Hitler emphasizes that he personally conducted the preparations. Indeed, the event loomed so large for him that he concludes the first volume of Mein Kampf with a description of it, because, he explains, it was the occasion when the party burst the narrow bonds of a small club and for the first time exerted a determining influence on the mightiest factor of our time, public opinion. Hitler was not even scheduled as the main speaker. This role was reserved for a certain Dr. Johannes Dingfelder, a homeopathic physician, a crackpot who contributed articles on economics to the newspapers under the pseudonym of Germanus Agricola, and who was soon to be forgotten. His speech was greeted with silence. Then Hitler began to speak. As he describes the scene, "There was a hail of shouts. There were violent clashes in the hall. A handful of the most faithful war comrades and other supporters battled with the disturbers. Communists and socialists, and only little by little were able to restore order. I was able to go on speaking. After half an hour, the applause slowly began to drown out the screaming and shouting. When, after nearly 4 hours, the hall began to empty, I knew that now the principles of the movement, which could no longer be forgotten, were moving out among the German people." In the course of his speech, Hitler had enunciated for the first time the 25 points of the program of the German Workers' Party. They had been hastily drawn up by Drexler, Fitter, and Hitler. Most of the heckling at Hitler had really been directed against parts of the program which he read out. But he nevertheless considered all the points as having been adopted, and they became the official program of the Nazi Party when its name was altered on April 1, 1920, to the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Indeed, for tactical reasons, Hitler in 1926 declared them unalterable. They are certainly a hodgepodge, a catch-all for the workers, the lower middle class, and the peasants, and most of them were forgotten by the time the party came to power. A good many writers on Germany have ridiculed them, and the Nazi leader himself was later to be embarrassed when reminded of some of them. Yet, as in the case of the main principles laid down in Mein Kampf, the most important of them were carried out by the Third Reich, with consequences disastrous to millions of people inside and outside of Germany. The very first point in the program demanded the union of all Germans in a greater Germany. Was this not exactly what Chancellor Hitler would insist on and get when he annexed Austria and its 6 million Germans? When he took the Sudetenland with its 3 million Germans? And was it not his demand for the return of German Danzig and the other areas in Poland inhabited predominantly by Germans, which led to the German attack on Poland and brought on World War II? And cannot it be added that it was one of the world's misfortunes that so many in the interwar years either ignored or laughed off the Nazi aims which Hitler had taken the pains to put down in writing? Surely the anti-Semitic points of the program promulgated in the Munich Beer Hall on the evening of February 24, 1920, constituted a dire warning. The Jews were to be denied office and even citizenship in Germany, and excluded from the press. All who had entered the Reich after August 2, 1914, were to be expelled. A good many paragraphs of the party program were obviously merely a demagogic appeal to the mood of the lower classes at a time when they were in bad straits, and were sympathetic to radical and even socialist slogans. Point 11, for example, demanded abolition of incomes unearned by work. Point 12, the nationalization of trusts. Point 13, the sharing with the state of profits from large industry. Point 14, the abolishing of land rents and speculation in land. Point 18 demanded the death penalty for traitors, usurers, and profiteers. And point 16, calling for the maintenance of a sound middle class, insisted on the communalization of department stores and their lease at cheap rates to small traders. These demands had been put in at the insistence of Drexler and Feder, who apparently really believed in the socialism of National Socialism. They were the ideas which Hitler was to find embarrassing when the big industrialists and landlords began to pour money into the party coffers, and of course nothing was ever done about them. There were finally 2 points of the program which Hitler would carry out as soon as he became chancellor. Point 2 demanded the abrogation of the treaties of Versailles and Saint-Germain. The last point, number 25, insisted on the creation of a strong central power of the state. This, like points 1 and 2, demanding the union of all Germans in the Reich and the abolition of the peace treaties, was put into the program at Hitler's insistence, and it showed how even then, when his party was hardly known outside Munich, he was casting his eyes on further horizons, even at the risk of losing popular support in his own bailiwick. Separatism was very strong in Bavaria at the time, and the Bavarians, constantly at odds with the central government in Berlin, were demanding less, not more, centralization, so that Bavaria could rule itself. In fact, this was what it was doing at the moment. Berlin's writ had very little authority in the states. Hitler was looking ahead for power not only in Bavaria, but eventually in the Reich, and to hold and exercise that power, a dictatorial regime such as he had already envisaged needed to constitute itself as a strong, centralized authority, doing away with the semi-autonomous states which under the Weimar Republic, as under the Hohenzollern Empire, enjoyed their own parliaments and governments. One of his first acts after January 30, 1933, was to swiftly carry out this final point in the party's program, which so few had noticed or taken seriously. No one could say he had not given ample warning in writing from the very beginning. Inflammatory oratory and a radical catch-all program, important as they were for a fledgling party out to attract attention and recruit mass support, were not enough. And Hitler now turned his attention to providing more, much more. The first signs of his peculiar genius began to appear and make themselves felt. What the masses needed, he thought, were not only ideas, a few simple ideas, that is, that he could ceaselessly hammer through their skulls, but symbols that would win their faith, pageantry and color that would arouse them, and acts of violence and terror which, if successful, would attract adherents. Were not most Germans drawn to the strong? And give them a sense of power over the weak. In Vienna, as we have seen, he was intrigued by what he called the infamous spiritual and physical terror, which he thought was employed by the Social Democrats against their political opponents. Now he turned it to good purpose in his own anti-socialist party. At first, ex-servicemen were assigned to the meetings to silence hecklers and, if necessary, toss them out. In the summer of 1920, soon after the party had added National Socialist to the name of the German Workers' Party and became the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or NSDAP, as it was now to be familiarly known, Hitler organized a bunch of roughneck war veterans into strong-arm squads, Ordnertruppe, under the command of Emil Maurice, an ex-convict and watchmaker. On October 5, 1921, after camouflaging themselves for a short time as the Gymnastic and Sports Division of the party to escape suppression by the Berlin government, they were officially named the Sturmabteilung, from which the name SA came. The stormtroopers, outfitted in brown uniforms, were recruited largely from the freebooters of the Free Corps and placed under the command of Johann Ulrich Klintzig, an aide of the notorious Captain Erhard, who had recently been released from imprisonment in connection with the murder of Erzberger. These uniformed rowdies, not content to keep order at Nazi meetings, soon took to breaking up those of the other parties. Once, in 1921, Hitler personally led his stormtroopers in an attack on a meeting which was to be addressed by a Bavarian Federalist by the name of Ballerstedt, who received a beating. For this, Hitler was sentenced to 3 months in jail, one of which he served. This was his first experience in jail, and he emerged from it somewhat of a martyr and more popular than ever. "It's all right," Hitler boasted to the police. "We got what we wanted. Ballerstedt did not speak." As Hitler had told an audience some months before, "the National Socialist movement will in the future ruthlessly prevent, if necessary by force, all meetings or lectures that are likely to distract the minds of our fellow countrymen." In the summer of 1920, Hitler, the frustrated artist but now becoming the master propagandist, came up with an inspiration which can only be described as a stroke of genius. What the party lacked, he saw, was an emblem, a flag, a symbol, which would express what the new organization stood for and appeal to the imagination of the masses, who, as Hitler reasoned, must have some striking banner to follow and to fight under. After much thought and innumerable attempts at various designs, he hit upon a flag with a red background, and in the middle a white disc on which was imprinted a black swastika. The hooked cross, the Hakenkreuz, of the swastika, borrowed though it was from more ancient times, was to become a mighty and frightening symbol of the Nazi Party, and ultimately of Nazi Germany. Whence Hitler got the idea of using it for both the flag and the insignia of the party, he does not say in a lengthy dissertation on the subject in Mein Kampf. The Hakenkreuz is as old, almost as man, on the planet. It has been found in the ruins of Troy, and of Egypt, and China. I myself have seen it in ancient Hindu and Buddhist relics in India. In more recent times, it showed up as an official emblem in such Baltic states as Estonia and Finland, where the men of the German Free Corps saw it during the fighting of 1918 to 1919. The Erhard Brigade had it painted on their steel helmets when they entered Berlin during the Kapp Putsch in 1920. Hitler had undoubtedly seen it in Austria in the emblems of one or the other anti-Semitic parties, and perhaps he was struck by it when the Erhard Brigade came to Munich. He says that numerous designs suggested to him by party members invariably included a swastika, and that a dentist from Sternberg actually delivered a design for a flag that was not bad at all and quite close to my own. For the colors, Hitler had of course rejected the black, red, and gold of the hated Weimar Republic. He declined to adopt the old imperial flag of red, white, and black, but he liked its colors not only because, he says, they form the most brilliant harmony in existence, but because they were the colors of a Germany for which he had fought. But they had to be given a new form, and so a swastika was added. Hitler reveled in his unique creation. "A symbol it really is," he exclaims in Mein Kampf. "In red, we see the social idea of the movement. In white, the nationalist idea. In the swastika, the mission of the struggle for the victory of the Aryan man." Soon the swastika armband was devised for the uniforms of the stormtroopers and the party members, and 2 years later Hitler designed the Nazi standards, which would be carried in the massive parades and would adorn the stages of the mass meetings. Taken from old Roman designs, they consisted of a black metal swastika on top, with a silver wreath surmounted by an eagle, and below the initials NSDAP on a metal rectangle from which hung cords with fringe and tassels, a square swastika flag with Deutschland erwache, Germany awake, emblazoned on it. This may not have been art, but it was propaganda of the highest order. The Nazis now had a symbol which no other party could match. The hooked cross seemed to possess some mystic power of its own, to beckon to action in a new direction the insecure lower middle classes which had been floundering in the uncertainty of the first chaotic post-war years. They began to flock under its banner.